Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those of you who, like me, know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are universally counterproductive, that none of them can be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, who is trying to mislead the people, to understand why they're doing so. Because ultimately, exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It's caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its empowering covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free anytime over the next 3 hours. It's 877-300-7645. The question is, are you willing to go where the evidence leads, even if a rational evaluation of the facts leads to a repudiation of your political and religious beliefs? In the show yesterday, I said there's something rotten in Denmark. Actually, I said there's something rotten in Ukraine, but that's not the colloquial phrase. So any time that you have a history of anti-Semitism, and when that anti-Semitism boils over into savage acts, and then when it leads to the demise of a population of Jews in a country, you know that there is something simmering underneath the veneer that is very, very troubling. It's why I have strongly encouraged us not to intervene in Ukraine. There is no good side here. There is no way to prevail. These people are not deserving of our support. Back a long time ago, back in November, when the violent uprising, they were never peaceful protests, despite what Susan Rice would tell Face the Nation. When they first began in Kiev, Putin responded by saying this reminds him of the pogroms. Now, at the time, I was probably as naive on pogroms as everyone else, and it was just another statement that Putin made. And in America, we have this tendency to want to vilify Putin that we just tossed out. Well, we did some study here. We came to understand why he used the term and learned that the most savage place in Europe for Jews to live, the most brutal treatment, the most deadly spot for Jews to live in the earliest 20th century in Europe was in Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands were murdered. Little infants had their heads bashed in against walls as they were twirled by the military and police in front of screaming mothers and fathers. The homes were raided. They were burnt to the ground. And their valuables were looted. This is the history of the Ukraine. It is one born out of Orthodox Christianity. It is why you have to be very suspect when choosing to support these people. Now, if that had been all there was to it, that 80 years ago they had been despicable, then perhaps you'd say, all right, why hold the current generation, even though it's exactly the same religious institution? You know, Odessa in the southern part of Ukraine is where the Russian Orthodox Church was born. It is the primary impetus for the religious hatred that has been foisted against Jews ever since Paul put a quill to papyrus nearly 2,000 years ago. And so what we find is that bygones are not bygones. And yesterday I went through the numbers to tell you how radically the Jewish population of the Ukraine has been decimated. The fact that in 1926 there were 1.6 million Jews in Ukraine. They were the third largest ethnic group after Ukrainians and Russians. 1.6 million, 6% of the population. By 1959, they represented just 2% of the population and had been halved. 840,000. But it didn't stop there. And 10 years later, in 1969, 777,000. And 1979, then 634,000. And 1989, 486,000. And just 12 years later, in 2001, 103,000. 0.2% of the population. A 16 times decline. Something terrible is going on, and it's still going on. A friend sent me this this article that I would like to share relative to this particular problem. The head of the most prominent European Jewish group in the Ukraine requested yesterday that the Israeli government urgently send security personnel to the Ukraine in order to protect Jewish communities that are still there. And this head of the largest European Jewish group said that they have been specifically targeted during the political unrest that is gripping the country. In a letter to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Moshe Yalon, the head of the European Jewish Association, Rabbi Menachem, urgently requested that Israel, quote, send trained security guards to protect Jewish communities in the Ukrainian cities and towns, end quote. Ukrainian Jewish communities throughout the Ukraine are seriously concerned and feel helpless in the face of a growing wave of anti-Semitic attacks, the letter stated, citing the recent examples of Molotov cocktails thrown at a Chabad center in the eastern cities and threatening phone messages left to rabbis calling for them to leave the city or be killed. And anti-Semitic graffiti that is found throughout Kiev. The reports indicate a Jewish emergency, according to the letter sent by the Brussels-based European Jewish Association. The recent Israeli Air Force flyover of Auschwitz, quote, conveyed a clear message that Israel will ensure the safety of Jews around the world, even in foreign countries, end quote, the rabbi wrote. So I, quote, urge you to take every possible measure, including the dispatch of security personnel, to ensure the safety of the Jewish communities in the Ukraine. Thought you ought to know. Our intuition was right. Well, we're going to get back to the Ukraine in a moment. I didn't want to bypass a horrible story. Now, those who have listened to this program know that I am not a promoter of political homosexuality. I do not care what someone's sexual orientation is. I have no interest whatsoever. And do not care that people choose one orientation or another. I do care when it is politicized. And that position doesn't change if the politicization of it, the approach to it in the body of a nation's politics, is to endorse the abnormal or to punish it. Either way. Morally, I'm opposed to it being punishable or it being promoted. Well, here's it's out of Uganda, and it's a horrible act on the far extreme. The article reads, in the latest setback for gay people across Africa, Ugandan President Museveni signed a law Monday that imposes tough penalties for homosexual acts, a move that drew condemnation from around the world and could jeopardize Uganda's relationship with the Obama administration and Western donors. Homosexuality was already illegal in Uganda. Now, making a person's sexual persuasion illegal I personally think, is as foolish as making drug use illegal. Now, people ought to be able to do whatever they wish to do, so long as what they're doing doesn't adversely affect others. Homosexuality, a sexual act, should be practiced discreetly in one's home or apartment. And if done so, it does not affect anyone. And then to make such an act illegal is a gross limitation of freedoms. The new legislation, however, threatens to issue in an era of harsh treatment of offenders and could lead to widespread oppression of gays and lesbians, human rights activists say. The legislation imposes a 14-year prison sentence for first-time offenders and life sentences for repeat offenders found guilty of homosexuality. That's repulsive. Putting people in jail for a day is unacceptable. Putting them in jail for 14 years and then for life because of their sexual preference? Revolting. Now, some might say, wait a minute, you were in favor of Putin's law. Why would you be in favor of Putin's law and opposed to this? Aren't they the same? They're both called anti-gay legislation. That Putin's law was properly designed. The Russian law did not criminalize homosexuality. It only criminalized the political promotion of homosexuality. Huge difference. I agree with Putin. A person's sexual choices ought not be part of the public discourse. And a abnormal choice, which homosexuality is, it's only 2% of the population, ought not be promoted. But it ought not be criminal either. And in Russia, it's not criminal to be a homosexual. It's not criminal to engage in homosexuality. Very different story in Uganda. This law goes one step further. It makes it a crime to fail to report anyone who is a homosexual. This is a horrible, horrible act. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Yes, when we consider what's happening in Uganda, it is a trilogy, if you will, of horrible decisions. One is to criminalize homosexuality and make the penalty egregious. 14 years for a first offense, lifetime for the second. The second is to make it a crime not to report someone who you suspect is a homosexual. When we turn society into rats that report on one another, that's a very, very serious decision that destroys trust in the culture. And when you have no trust, everything falls apart. And then the third aspect of is that a day after Uganda passed the harsh penalties for homosexuality, they published a list of suspected homosexuals. The cover of the Red Pepper newspaper read, "Exposed," all in caps, exclamation point, "Uganda's 200 top homos named," with several photographs next to the headlines. That kind of behavior is uncivilized. Now, I'm here to tell you that my view towards homosexuality, personally, I don't condone it. I'm not in favor of it. My position happens to be the same as God's. God doesn't like it either. That is my view. Happens to be the same as God's view. But Yahweh is a free will entity, deity. He is first and foremost a supporter of choice, of freedom, of his children being free, and those who choose to ignore him or to be opposed to him also being free to do so. And so I'd like to conclude this story, which is, of course, the quicksand of the media these days, by saying that Putin was right. You ought to be free to be whatever you want to be, to do whatever you want to do, so long as it does not negatively influence others. And Uganda is dead wrong in making it a crime punishable by years in prison for someone to be who they are. And for us to impose our will on others. It is the problem of democracy, is that so many countries around the world, for various reasons, have peculiarities where various positions are deeply seated, typically because of religion. And to impose those on everyone is something that obliterates choice. And you will never find God on the side of obliterating choice. I spent a little more time studying what was going on in Ukraine, primarily because it is yet another hot spot for what appears to be the world powers positioning themselves against one another. And it's also so interesting also because of the fact that what we're witnessing in Ukraine, I believe, is a harbinger of what we're going to witness in the West and particularly in America. You know, the bottom line is that the Ukrainians wanted lavish pensions. And they wanted artificially low cost of living with the government underwriting costs, particularly of fuel. And by doing these things, they created a bloated government that was way too costly and had to borrow money from other nations to support the population's covetousness, the population's greed. And they essentially destroyed the country on behalf of themselves and on behalf of their children. Now they are destitute. Their hand is outreached, expecting someone to supply them with the money that they can then lavish on themselves. It is a extraordinarily important picture for us in America to understand, because government pensions in America are out of whack. We're going to present a story on that either later today or tomorrow. But they're completely out of whack. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme that is bankrupting the country. So is Medicare and the new Affordable Care Act. And so when we come to understand that what we're witnessing in Ukraine, of them being bankrupt and of them protesting against any attempt at imposing austerity, cutting the government back, while also biting off the arm of the only nation that was willing to provide them with loans, is exactly what we're going to see here. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we consider the two issues that are going to influence the Russian response in the Ukraine, I'd like to welcome Glenn back to the program, because I think Glenn wants to make a comment on the ultimate danger zone of radio, which is any conversation about homosexuality. So now, Glenn, you get a chance to skate out into the thin ice.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Good morning. Good morning, Jacob.
Yeah, really.
I mean, I know you say your name is Jada, but if somebody else told me it's Jada, so I'm just going to stick with that.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, and I think it's just fine. Okay, now, about the Ugandan homosexuality thing. Well, controversial indeed.
Yes.
You know, if you think the Ugandan law is bad for locking people in jail, imagine how bad it would be for someone to say that if a man lies with a man as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination and they shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a pretty horrible thing to say, don't you think?
Well, that depends on the context and, of course, who is saying it. For a human government to say it in a place other than Israel, where God is trying to establish his covenant so that the whole world might come to know him, it is inappropriate for God to say that, you know, I was the source of your life. And so if you're going to do these kinds of things, I'm going to foreshorten the life that I myself gave you. It's an entirely different proposition.
Right. Well, but I mean, the point being that Yahweh says that this is something for which people shall be put to death, presumably by humans, and that their blood is upon them. Not on the hands.
Yeah. Actually, most of these statements are written in such a way that using the Hebrew stems and conjugations, which you discover is that person is going to die. And what God is saying is that if you are so egregiously disrespectful of the nature of the covenant, which is where a man and woman come together in marriage and conceive and raise children in a loving environment, that if you want to flaunt, particularly in Israel, the nature of this, the greatest gift that God has ever given us, which is the covenant relationship, that you're going to die. That will be the natural consequence of opposing the covenant. That's the message. Okay. I've put Glenn on hold mainly because of the fact that his phone connection was so bad that it was way too garbled. God is really not the least bit accommodating among the children of Israel in particular, because they serve as his witness to the world. 100% of what God had to say to us and was committed to writing was conveyed through Israelites. And so in the Promised Land, in his home, that tiny little strip of land, very clear and unequivocal instructions regarding those kinds of things which would tarnish, would sully the primary thing he was attempting to offer all of us, which is the opportunity to participate in his covenant. And so it is one thing for the author of life, we would not even exist without that, foreshortening someone's mortal existence when it's clear that they would have no chance of an eternal existence, for doing something that tarnishes the single most important aspect of creation, that being the covenant. Now I'm going to return to Russia. There are two issues in Russia we ought to be cognizant of as it relates to the Ukraine. The first of those happens to be the military bases, particularly the Russian fleet in the Crimean Peninsula. Personally, I don't think that's at a significant risk. And the reason I don't think it's a significant risk, if you look at the Russian population in the Ukraine, in the Crimean Peninsula, which is where the Russians have their largest Navy base, the ethnic Russians represent 60% of the population in the entirety of the Crimean Peninsula. So that base is not going to be threatened. The ethnic Ukrainians have absolutely no chance and no influence of affecting the Crimean Peninsula. If you look at a map of the Ukraine from a racial perspective, and you look at the two largest racial groups, which would be the Russians and the Ukrainians, with the Russians wanting to continue to have close ties with the Russians, and the Ukrainians wanting to have closer ties with Europe. If you look at the western part of the Ukraine, the percentage of Russians averages less than 4%. If you look at the north-central part of the Ukraine, the Russian population, that would be where Kiev is, averages in on the range of 6 to 9%. But if you look at the south and the east of the Ukraine, along the Black Sea, what you find is that in where Odessa is, in southwest Ukraine, the Russians represent 21%. In the Crimean Peninsula, the further southern part of Ukraine, it is 60%. And then in eastern Ukraine, in southeastern Ukraine, the Russians represent anywhere from 26 to 40% of the population. So there is a 0% possibility that Russia is going to abandon any Russian community where the population is greater than 20% Russian. So all we're looking at here is, should those protesting in Kiev, the Ukrainians, prevail and they get someone to bail them out, which is going to be difficult because I don't think either Europe nor the United States has any interest in providing them with $20 billion of additional debt, then we're going to see the Ukraine split apart. And the Russians are going to control the eastern part of the Ukraine and the southern Ukraine. And the Ukrainians are going to control the north and the west. Now, the other aspect of Ukraine, and the reason that this, the primary reason that we are in this mess, is not just the extravagant pensions that are paid to Ukrainians for not working. It's their desire to have the government underwrite natural gas and oil. And so if you look at where Russia sits, which is now Russia is a huge exporter of oil, and Russia's pipelines from Siberia and from the Caspian Sea do pass through the Ukraine. Now, there's only one pipeline of consequence that passes through the Ukraine. So Russia is the exclusive source of oil for the Ukraine and gas for the Ukraine. And so if Russia were to say tomorrow, you know, sorry, boys, but this is the way you want to play the game. Good luck with electricity. Good luck with fueling your cars. Good luck lighting your homes. We're out of here. They would be in a hell of a fix. I'm sure they didn't think that through. But the Russians also have a huge vested interest in a pipeline that goes through western Ukraine, where the Russians represent a very small percentage of the population. It's called the Friendship Pipeline, and it is the largest pipeline network in the world. It is the lifeblood also of Europe as it relates to natural gas and oil. So there is a 0% possibility that Russia or Europe is going to allow that pipeline to be turned off. And therefore, what does Russia do to maintain control over the free flow of gas and oil through those pipelines? That's an issue that if you don't keep your eye on, it's going to be very difficult to understand what is going to happen in that region. Now, here's a summation of it. The reality today is that Russia supplies 31% of the European Union's gas imports, a third of the entirety of the European Union's gas imports. And it's of certain countries. It's in the range of two-thirds. 27% of crude oil imports, 24% of the European Union's coal imports, and 30% of the total uranium imports. In other words, should Russia tell Europe, we're not going to supply you with uranium, coal, oil, or gas, they're in the dark. EU is not only Russia's largest trading partner, but it is the market for 88% of Russia's oil exports, 70% of its gas exports, and 50% of its coal exports. Ties between Russia and the Ukraine, by the way, are beyond just these oil pipelines, beyond just the military bases and the naval bases and the Crimean Peninsula. There's actually a decades-old tie between Russians and Ukrainians. And I think I misspoke when I said Odessa was the birthplace of Orthodox Russian Christianity. It's actually Kiev. And Russia's national religion, therefore, was conceived in the Ukraine. Modern-day Ukrainians and Russians are also part of what was called the Kievan Rus, a federation of Slavic tribes in Europe from the late 9th century through the mid-13th century. And by the 11th century, the Kievan Rus was the main cultural center in Eastern Europe. So for all of the salient reasons between Russia and Ukraine, they have much in common when it comes to culture and history, even to racial background. And so none of these things are going to be completely overlooked. When we return, I'm going to share a little bit more about the Druzhba pipeline, which is Russian for the friendship pipeline, where it comes from, where it runs to, and whether or not Russia will let it go. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I do want to just briefly speak about this pipeline because oil is the and gas are the impetus for this problem. It is a the problem in Ukraine is a problem of covetousness individuals wanting the government to provide entitlements to them well beyond what they are willing themselves to fund. And so they have become increasingly in debt, although their debt is only one third to one fourth of the level of American debt. But that not only are pensions a big aspect of the problem, but energy is as well. And when you are a net importer of energy, as is the United States, as is the Ukraine, you are in a very desperate situation. Well, the Druzhba pipeline, which is Russian for friendship pipeline, is the world's longest oil pipeline, and in fact one of the biggest oil pipeline networks in the world. It carries oil some 4,000 kilometers, 2,500 miles, from the eastern part of European Russia to points in the Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Germany. Actually, there's more countries than that, and I'll speak to them in a moment. The network also branches out into numerous pipelines to deliver its product throughout the eastern portion of Europe and into Western Europe. Now, this pipeline runs through the western Ukraine. In fact, 1,500 kilometers, 930 miles through western Ukraine, where the Russian population is, you know, averages less than 5%. That pipeline, because the friendship pipeline divides in two. In Russia, it might even be in Belarus, but it divides into, it has a southern and a northern leg. The northern leg goes and takes oil and gas to not only northern Germany, but to the Baltic Sea, where it can be then distributed through Sweden and Finland and Latvia and Norway and countries like that. The southern leg is the source of virtually all gas and oil for Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, central and southern Germany, eastern France, Austria, Croatia, Slovenia, and northern Italy. There's a lot at stake here, folks. The next thing I would like to share as it relates to the Ukrainian situation, and I'm going to eventually drop the Ukraine. And the only reason that I wanted to provide an education base for our listeners on it is because I'm very concerned when the United States promotes propagandic rhetoric that is so destructive to understanding, because it usually does so in as a as a pretense for doing something horrible. And so when the United States began to present the Ukraine situation as peaceful, widespread public protests, which were ravaged by a singular man loyal to Putin, who gunned down and killed his own people en masse. That was the American pretense as presented by Obama and by Susan Rice on behalf of the Obama administration. That's the pretense for America to engage and do something stupid. And it's not true. And if you can't present the facts as they are, then you respond based upon an illusion, a false representation of what's occurring, a grotesque corruption of the truth, then people can easily be persuaded to go along with horrible decisions. I mean, it's exactly what happened, my friends, in terms of Afghanistan, where Afghanistan was blamed for 9/11. Not true. It's what happened in Iraq, where we said, oh, Saddam Hussein is gassing his own people. It's so grotesquely misleading that we ought to go invade there because he's a bad man. It's grotesquely inappropriate. And it led to a devastating consequence. We said the same thing about Assad. When if it's true of Assad, it's even more true of Lincoln. We ought to be bombing the Lincoln Memorial and removing Lincoln's image from everything American. If what we have said about Assad were actually true. And so it is this misrepresentation of information that then leads to horribly bad decisions and actions that should be thwarted. And so we're going to talk about the Ukraine for that reason.